Welcome to this audio issue of The Big Secret on Wall Street, published and copyrighted by Porter & Company, all rights reserved. Please note that this recording was generated via AI and may contain minor transcription errors and pronunciation mistakes. Throughout this issue, I may reference charts, graphs, and imagery that can only be viewed on our website at porterandcompanyresearch.com. This issue was originally published on October 9, 2025. Always in the shadows, always in control. This isn't a business. It's a 400-year-old dynasty. And it's trading at a 30% discount from fair value. We all remember Alexander the Liberator. Well, now we'll have Vladimir the Underpants Poisoner. So spoke Russian political dissident Alexei Navalny, hanging on to life in a Berlin hospital in September 2020 after Russian President Vladimir Putin's goons had dusted the inseam of his jockey shorts with Novichok nerve gas. 2 days earlier, Navalny pulled up his drawers in a hotel room in Siberia, hopped on a plane for Moscow, and became violently ill mid-flight. After an emergency landing and an airlift to the hospital during which he was completely naked, Navalny survived and ultimately blew the whistle on a series of intricately corrupt Russian oil deals. Navalny was just one in an impressive lineup of Vladimir Putin's poisoning victims, the rare one who lived to tell the tale, at least for 4 more years. In Russia, if the nerve agent doesn't get you, the Arctic Circle penal colony will. To be fair to Putin, he was just carrying on a grand Russian poisoning tradition that dated back 100 years. In 1921, Vladimir Lenin, the first chairman of Soviet Russia, narrowly dodged a bullet, realized he had too many enemies, and commissioned a secret poison lab called simply the Kamara, or chamber. There, government scientists experimented on political prisoners to create odorless, tasteless, undetectable poisons, often with symptoms that cleverly mimicked other illnesses. Some of their greatest hits included a gas pistol that could shoot liquid up to 65 feet and a special poison that could be sprayed onto a light bulb and dispersed via heat. Officially, the Kamara didn't exist. It shifted from building to building, underground room to basement hideaway. While no one knows exactly where the lab is located these days, defected Russian spies, like Alexander Litvinenko, who died in 2006 after drinking radioactive tea, report that it's still fully operational. During the 20th century, the Kamara's ingenious poison menu would serve a who's who of Russian political enemies, including in 1955 defector Nikolai Kokhlov, thallium-laced coffee, Afghan leader Hafizullah Amin in 1979, poisoned food, anti-Soviet writer Lev Rebet in 1957, a puff of cyanide mist to the face, and anti-communist journalist Georgi Markov in 1978, a single subcutaneously injected pellet of ricin. And when Putin took over as prime minister in 1999, he was only too happy to carry on the good work. Putin, the diminutive strongman who spent the past quarter century as the leader of Russia, generally gets what he wants. And in 2008, after he'd tested Kamara poisons on a few lower-level antagonists, he knew exactly what he wanted next. His next round of odorless, tasteless nerve gas would snuff out the top man at BP Energy. In Soviet Russia, gas gets you. Putin had had his sights on BP for quite a while. With an eye to creating a Russian oil mega-monopoly, he'd already forced independent Russian energy companies Yukos and Sibneft to fall under the ownership of state-owned oil giant Rosneft in the early 2000s. Yukos CEO, who didn't like the plan, was thrown in prison on trumped-up tax evasion charges, and the CEO of Sibneft sold quietly at a 75% discount. Now, Putin was circling in on bigger prey, multinational oil conglomerates TNK-BP. The TNK half of TNK-BP was already controlled by Russian holding company R. However, British oil supermajor BP owned the other half, and they weren't keen on selling their slice of a lucrative 1.6 million barrel a day concern. BP CEO Bob Dudley was a particular pain in Putin's zadnitsa. Under Dudley's leadership, TNK-BP's oil output had increased by a third, and he refused to step down from a successful business. When buyout negotiations stalled, Putin ramped up his pressure campaign. Armed police halted operations at BP's Moscow headquarters and conducted mysterious document raids. Dudley and his American employees all began to experience visa problems. Dudley himself, in a clear callback to the Yukos CEO's fate, was questioned for 5 hours about tax evasion. Nothing worked, so Vladimir the Underpants Poisoner brought out the good stuff. It wasn't in Dudley's drawers, though. It was in the food in the company cafeteria. A subtle dusting, meant to ramp up illness over time. But Dudley, who'd already started passing notes rather than speak aloud in his office, was on high alert. According to a U.S. embassy cable later released by WikiLeaks, on a trip out of Russia, according to three people close to BP, he had his blood tested, and poison was found in his bloodstream. He stopped eating food provided by the company and began to feel better. When Dudley didn't die, Putin, tired of cat-and-mouse games, sent the police to the CEO's front door to arrest him. From WikiLeaks, we learn, he went out the back door of his apartment to a waiting car and left the country. Clearly, though, Dudley was spooked. 5 months later, he officially tendered his resignation from TNK-BP. The buyout proceeded without incident, and Russian state oil giant Rosneft absorbed the entire concern, for $27 billion, 40% of fair value, in 2013. The underpants poisoner gets what he wants, almost always. With one very notable exception. Not even Putin will go after this company. At least 20 high-profile deaths or imprisonments, including lawyer Sergei Magnitsky, died in custody in 2009 after exposing fraud, and Alexander Litvinenko, poisoned in 2006, and pictured here shaking hands with Putin, were linked to Putin's efforts to control all of Russia's energy complex. Why did Putin seek to dominate this industry? The oldest reasons of all, wealth and power. Putin saw that the Western powers were weak, feminized, and fragmented. He knew NATO wouldn't engage in things like espionage, blackmail, or murder. He knew he could seize their assets easily, as if from children, without consequence. Today, through various frontmen, known internationally as wallets, Putin owns and controls virtually the entire Russian energy industry. Russia's government holds 50.23% of Gazprom and over 50% of Rosneft. That gives Putin effective control of these companies, where his loyalist appointees, Gazprom CEO Alexei Miller and Rosneft CEO Igor Sechin, siphon billions in tribute to Putin every month. The 2016 Panama Papers, a compilation of leaked international documents, proved other Putin associates like Sergei Roldagin hold hundreds of billions worth of shares in these companies directly. Other wallets like Gennady Timchenko, $20 billion net worth from energy deals, receive rich contracts and royalties. All are fronts for Putin. As a result, it's likely Putin is the wealthiest man in the world. But during Putin's power-driven energy blitzkrieg, there was one institution not even Putin was willing to cross. It is an ancient kiretsu, a network of closely collaborative businesses, one that no one mentions by name. It owns virtually nothing openly or directly. It follows the single most important law of power. The greatest trick the devil ever played on men was convincing them he wasn't real. And, just as Sun Tzu taught, the ideal general wins without a battle by focusing on long-term advantages rather than short-term clashes. Asia is controlled by only a few dozen families, and the most powerful families are hidden from the public. They do not operate directly, or in the open, but instead through a huge web of holding companies, kuretsus. They control banks, insurance companies, and have privileged access to government capital. Rather than seeking formal control, they sell majority stakes to prominent operators, while always secretly holding the reins of power. They are masters of discretion, masters at accounting, masters at being able to accurately value each portion of a corporation's capital stack. And most of all, they are the uncontested masters at long-term strategy. They do not measure results quarterly. They measure results by the century. And by doing so, they maximize their return on invested capital in ways no other business in the world can. Most of all, they do not lose money, nor do they allow any business difficulty, even a war, like Putin, to distract them from their goal, which is the long-term appreciation of their capital. And like Putin, they are capable of doing whatever must be done to protect their rights and interests. There isn't anyone they won't kill, not even Putin. But conflict is always their very last option. Over hundreds of years, they've learned that real power is having the ability to destroy everyone, but choosing not to do it. There are perhaps a dozen companies like this in Asia, but the leading five are in Japan. They are known as the Sogo Shosha, which translates into integrated trading company. They are integrated in the sense that they control both their sources of capital and have integrated supply and production chains. The only American business that functions even remotely in this fashion is Berkshire Hathaway, which uses its massive insurance float, around $175 billion, to fund its investments in dozens of leading U.S. companies. But in Japan, the Sogo Shosha play a far deeper cultural role, functioning in many ways like ancient shoguns, protectors of Japan's long-term interests, and they lord over the entire society, including the government. And there's one master that rises above all of these ancient houses. It maintains a 400-year-old tradition as the most powerful of all kuretsu. It is the master of Japan's financial markets, trading houses, and industries across all of Asia. It's called Mitsui. Mitsui is more than a leading Japanese conglomerate, it is the house of Japan. It doesn't merely dominate the culture, it is the culture. Putin knew, Mitsui is immortal, and unbreakable. Stealing from Mitsui would have been suicide, for Putin and for Russia. And so when Putin was deciding what to do with Sakhalin 2, he knew he had to be pragmatic. Sakhalin 2 is an enormous oil, gas, and liquefied natural gas, LNG, project that attracted large amounts of foreign capital, almost $100 billion. The deal, which was inked in 1994, didn't begin operations for 15 years, in 2009. But long before the oil started flowing, Putin decided to kick the foreign investors out and keep the resource for himself. But Mitsui was one of the earliest investors in the deal. In 2006, Rosprirodnadzor, Russia's Federal Service for Supervision of Natural Resources, responsible for environmental compliance and fines, launched investigations, citing pipeline violations and estimating $30 billion in damages. After investing tens of billions, the partners in Sakhalin 2, Shell 50%, Mitsui 25%, Mitsubishi 10%, were faced with a metaphoric gun to their heads, while real guns were being pointed at members of their staff. Permits were revoked in September 2006. Putin demanded that the foreign investors hand over 50% of the equity for a token payment, or else the project would never pump a barrel of oil. He argued that the 1994 agreement was made with a corrupt government on unconventional terms that were unfair to Russia. Specifically, the deal prevented Russia from sharing in any energy revenue until all the development costs were repaid to the partners, but the costs kept going higher, effectively pricing Russia out of any revenue for decades. The partners agreed that keeping some of a good deal was better than losing 100% of a great deal. Gazprom acquired 50% plus one share for $7.45 billion from the partners. Going forward, costs were capped at $15.8 billion, forcing the partners to eat $3.6 billion in cost overrun absorption. And then, Putin took his pound of flesh. The Russians demanded Shell pay an extra $100 million annual priority dividend to Gazprom. Because fuck you, that's why. Ownership became Gazprom 50% plus one share, Shell 27.5%, Mitsui 12.5%, Mitsubishi 10%. Mitsui's survival stemmed from its role in Japan and in Asia as a whole. Yes, the Russians bought back half their equity stake, but they didn't steal from Mitsui. And they didn't blame Mitsui for the cost overruns or force it to pay extra tribute, the extra $100 million a year it extracted from Shell. And look what happened next. Following the Russians' mid-deal renegotiation of Sakhalin 2, the government of Japan made Mitsui shareholders whole. In 2008, Mitsui secured $5.3 billion in loans from the Japan Bank for International Cooperation, $3.7 billion, and private banks, $1.6 billion. These non-recourse loans refinanced the company's entire Sakhalin 2 capital costs. This left Mitsui as the owner of 12.5% of Russia's first-ever LNG export facility, all financed with non-recourse loans with interest rates below 1%. Mitsui isn't a normal holding company. It is part of Japan's strategic plan to acquire and retain critical energy, metals, and food. That's why it is granted capital at remarkably low rates. And it's why Japan's government offers it foreign insurance on deals that rely on sovereign nations, that, like Russia, may or may not live up to their word. This combination, a brilliant, family-led, 400-year-old conglomerate, backed by the full power of Japan's government, is the world's most formidable, long-term investor. Mitsui's investing is a lot like Warren Buffett's, except instead of the insurance companies putting up the free capital, in Japan it's the banks and the government. That's a crucial difference that most investors don't understand, but this might help explain it. The Sakhalin 2 ordeal wasn't over. In early 2022, when Russia invaded Ukraine, the world hit Russia with sanctions, making it virtually impossible for Western companies to do business in Russia. Shell exited the deal with a final $1.6 billion write-off. Through the life of this deal, Shell wasted a ton of capital and, in the end, walked away with only losses. It spent $10 billion to $12 billion in initial capex. It extracted $5 billion to $7 billion net profits from 2009 to 2022. Even so, total estimated losses were $4 billion to $6 billion over almost 30 years. In the 2022 takeover, Putin took control of the entire company. Shell stake went to Russia's largest natural gas producer, Pau Novatek, for $1.1 billion and then it was sold to Gazprom. But what about Mitsui and Mitsubishi? Putin asked them to reapply to be part of the new consortium. Mitsui reapplied and retained its full 12.5% stake. No further capital required. No tribute. Even today, Mitsui continues to receive $150 million to $200 million annual contributions by persisting in the deal. Mitsui's core cultural strategy is based on a pragmatic willingness to compromise and adapt when direct confrontation would lead to certain defeat. And it never lets its opponents forget that Mitsui is eternal, lose as many battles as necessary as long as you win the war. In Sakhalin, while Shell's insistence on maintaining operational control and pushing back against environmental audits escalated the conflict, leading to its eventual ouster and major losses, Mitsui adopted a lower profile. As a minority stakeholder without day-to-day oversight, it avoided becoming the primary target of Russian regulators. Mitsui was focused on securing long-term energy supplies for Japan, not getting the last nickel in the deal. This approach, yielding ground to preserve core interests, stands in stark contrast to Shell's more confrontational stance, which amplified scrutiny and ultimately costed billions. Such wisdom is rare in today's global business landscape, where companies often prioritize short-term principles over long-term survival. But for Mitsui, this strategy is embedded in its DNA, honed over hundreds of years of dealing with unpredictable sovereign rulers. To understand Mitsui today, one must trace this thread back through Japan's turbulent history, where the company evolved from a merchant house into an institution that not only survived sovereign threats but shaped the nation's destiny. A brief look at Mitsui's long history. The roots of Mitsui's resilience trace to 1673, when Takatoshi Mitsui opened a drapery shop in Edo, Tokyo. Born into a family of sake brewers in Matsusaka, Takatoshi broke tradition by moving to retail. Unlike the barter systems common at the time, he introduced fixed prices and cash sales, making shopping accessible to commoners rather than just the elite samurai class, his traditional customers. This shift allowed his store to thrive and evolve into Mitsukoshi, one of Japan's premier department store chains, though it is no longer controlled by the Mitsui family today. By the early 1700s, the Mitsus had expanded into money lending and exchange services, functioning like banks in a society where formal financial institutions were scarce. It was their banking prowess, and the information advantages this gave them, for example, knowing the true price of gold, that transformed them into one of the dozen most powerful families in the world. Think the Japanese version of the Rothschild. In 1694, Takatoshi established the family's house rules, a set of 17 principles that have guided Mitsui for over three centuries. These rules, known as the Sakiku Isho, emphasized ruthless pragmatism. Avoid unnecessary risks, prioritize long-term stability over short-term gains, and maintain family unity through strict governance. The full list is as follows. Rule 1. The family business shall be managed collectively by all branches of the Mitsui family, with no single branch claiming ownership. Rule 2. Family members must prioritize the prosperity of the house over personal gain. Rule 3. All major decisions, including marriages and adoptions, must be approved by the family council to maintain unity. Rule 4. Frugality is essential to preserve capital, avoid luxury and extravagance. Rule 5. Diligence in business is mandatory. Laziness will not be tolerated. Rule 6. Education of heirs should focus on practical skills for commerce, not scholarly pursuits. Rule 7. Disputes among family members must be resolved internally, without involving outsiders or courts. Rule 8. The family reserve fund must be maintained for emergencies and business expansion. Rule 9. Branches must contribute a portion of profits to the central family fund. Rule 10. To avoid conflicts with business interests, no family member may engage in politics or hold public office. Rule 11. Adoption of capable non-blood relatives is encouraged to bring fresh talent into the family. Rule 12. Business risks should be shared among branches to distribute potential losses. Rule 13. Innovation in business practices is encouraged, but only after careful consideration. Rule 14. Family members must live modestly, setting an example for employees. Rule 15. Succession should favor competence over birth order. Rule 16. The family must adapt to changing times while upholding core principles. Rule 17. These rules are eternal and must be passed down unchanged to future generations. If you're looking for where Buffett might have made his biggest mistake, it was in not understanding these rules. He's allowed massive amounts of his capital to be squandered by a non-family member, Bill Gates. Rather than retaining his family's interests in Berkshire, he allowed his sons to indulge in worthless pursuits and frivolity. He allowed his wife to disgrace him. Buffett would have never survived feudal Japan. In feudal Japan, merchants occupied the lowest social rung. They were below warriors, farmers, and artisans, yet they wielded economic power that brought on envy and regulation from the ruling shogunate. They were always a target. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Once again, the wealthy are the targets of the ruling class, whose never-ending spending has bankrupted every Western government. These rules ensured Mitsui could survive those challenges without fracturing, a quality that mirrored Japan's cultural emphasis on group harmony and endurance. By the mid-1800s, Mitsui had become Japan's wealthiest merchant house, with annual revenue that dwarfed major feudal lords. Ruled by the Tokugawa shogunate, Japan had spent 250 years under a system of centralized control and extreme isolation. The regime's isolationist Sakoku policy, enforced from the 1630s, restricted foreign trade to a single Dutch outpost in Nagasaki, limiting exposure to Western ideas and technology to prevent colonial incursions and preserve cultural purity. This isolation began to crack in 1853 when U.S. Commodore Matthew Perry arrived with his black ships, steam-powered warships far superior to Japan's wooden fleet, demanding trade concessions. The resulting Treaty of Kanagawa in 1854 opened two ports to American vessels, granting extraterritorial rights to foreigners and unequal trade terms that favored the U.S. for America. The strategic objective was securing coaling stations for Pacific expansion and opening Asian markets to counter British influence. For Japan, the goal was avoiding war with a technologically superior power while minimizing internal unrest from anti-foreign factions. This upheaval threatened the shogunate's authority, sparking debates between those loyal to the reform-minded emperor and those loyal to the shogunate lords. Mitsui, as official merchants to the shogunate, handling tax collections and loans, appeared to back the shogunate, but under the brilliant leadership of an adopted family member, Minomura Riziman, Mitsui made a daring pivot. In 1866 it began funneling over 100,000 ryo, a gold-based currency worth about $1,000 per coin, to imperial loyalists in Satsuma and Chashu. Mitsui's support also included smuggling rifles from Europe and providing intelligence on shogunal finances. For Mitsui, the risk was existential. Discovery meant execution, asset seizure, or family ruin in a society where merchants had no legal protections against samurai authority. Mitsui was betting everything on the imperial side, defying its longtime patron. To put the danger in perspective, this would be like Warren Buffett using Berkshire Hathaway to support a revolution in the U.S. Failure would erase centuries of wealth. But the gamble paid off. Japan enters the modern world. The Meiji Restoration in 1868 overthrew the shogunate and thus began Japan's emergence as a modern, industrial nation. Without merchants like Mitsui risking their fortunes, the restoration would have faltered, delaying Japan's industrial leap and leaving it vulnerable to colonization, as happened to much of Asia. Mitsui's actions were pivotal. It provided the financial backbone for Japan's transformation from a feudal society to an industrial power, funding everything from currency reforms to military upgrades. Its unique role in Japan's history earned Mitsui a special role in Japan's society. It is very much a shadow state, the corporate arm of the empire. This story has profound parallels to America today. I wonder if the leaders of Amazon, or Google, J.P. Morgan or Berkshire Hathaway, would bet their lives and their fortunes trying to save America from its government. Someone will have to, eventually. In 1872, Mitsui founded Japan's first private bank, Mitsui Bank, with 2 million yen capital, about $200 million today, to stabilize the currency amid inflation from new paper money. The bank financed railroads, like the Tokyo-Yokohama line, and telegraphs, laying the foundation for modern connectivity. Mitsui monopolized key trades. By the 1880s, it handled 80% of raw silk exports, a vital foreign exchange earner equivalent to oil today. In 1889, it acquired the Mite coal mine for $30 million in today's money, Japan's largest at 1.5 million tons annual output, powering steel mills for ships and weapons. By 1912, it controlled 15% of Japan's total corporate capital, employing tens of thousands. And throughout this incredible, multi-decade transformation, its house rules ensured continuity. Decisions required family consensus, preventing the infighting that doomed rivals. This structure reflects Japan's collectivist culture. Group harmony trumps individual ambition. Mitsui's imperial role deepened in the 1930s, supporting Japan's expansion into Manchuria with coal and soy investments. During World War II, it supplied resources for the military, a collaboration born of necessity in a totalitarian regime. But victory for the Allies in 1945 brought a new threat. The Supreme Commander for the Allied Powers, SCAP, led by General Douglas MacArthur. This legal assault came from Washington's New Dealers, progressive reformers inspired by U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt's antitrust policies, who labeled Mitsui a feudal monopoly. Figures like T.A. Bisson, a State Department advisor and author of Japan's War Economy, argued Mitsui's scale and financial integration suppressed labor and competition. He proposed full nationalization. And so when the 1947 Zaibatsu Dissolution Directive targeted 83 conglomerates, Mitsui was on the list. The government seized family-held stock worth $100 million in today's dollars. It then redistributed these shares to employees and the public, American communism at its finest. Mitsui's holding company was dissolved, its bank was reorganized, and its executives purged. But Mitsui is eternal. Unlike more rigid rivals, it complied while leveraging its cultural values of unity and pragmatism. Family members gracefully accepted compensation in inflation-eroded bonds, and they waited and waited. By 1949, as Cold War fears shifted U.S. priorities, fearing a weak Japan vulnerable to communism, SCAP softened, allowing Mitsui's reformation into Kyuretsu. Alliances centered on banks like Mitsui Bank, now Sumitomo Mitsui. This preserved networks through cross-shareholdings, enabling Mitsui to resume trade and rebuild. You can't kill an idea. Deep inside the ethos of Mitsui lies a profound truth. Japan, an island nation, depends on trade for its existence. As long as Mitsui ensures access to trade and success in trade, it will remain, and it will remain more powerful than any political tide or economic depression. Mitsui's historical pragmatism finds a modern echo in Warren Buffett. Buffett knew essentially the same thing. The business of America is business. As long as he could deliver investment excellence, his power would never wane. Over his career, Buffett transformed a struggling New England textile mill, Berkshire Hathaway, into a $900 billion conglomerate that mirrors the structure and strategy of Japan's Sogo Shosha. Just as Mitsui and its peers have built vast trading networks using low-cost capital to invest across industries, Buffett has built Berkshire as an American version of these entities, a global powerhouse that uses its financial might, its insurance float, to stack leading business after leading business, producing unmatched returns on invested capital. Thus, it was hardly a surprise when on August 31, 2020, Buffett announced his investments in the Japanese trading firms. Berkshire disclosed approximately 5% stakes in each of the five major Sogo Shosha: Itochu Corporation, Marubeni Corporation, Mitsubishi Corporation, Mitsui & Company, and Sumitomo Corporation. And keeping the low cost of capital strategy in mind, he borrowed virtually every penny he invested via the issuance of low-cost yen bonds at rates as low as 0.5%. Buffett's rationale: hey, if the Japanese people want to print trillions of yen and let me borrow it to buy their greatest assets, then I'm your huckleberry. By October 2025, these positions had appreciated about 117% to $30 billion, making them Buffett's largest ever investments outside of Apple, AAPL, and American Express, AXP. These investments have also delivered $2.1 billion in cumulative dividends net of interest costs. Seeing these results, Buffett has been increasing his stakes in the strongest of these firms, like Mitsubishi, to 10.23%, and Mitsui & Company, above 10%, citing their resemblance to Berkshire itself. As he wrote in his 2023 shareholder letter, "These companies will likely increase their dividends as the years pass, just as we expect them to increase their intrinsic value per share." Although overshadowed in scale by his Apple investment, given that 100% of the capital into the Sogo Shosha was borrowed, I believe this is Buffett's greatest ever investment. And, I suspect, the real value of Buffett's last trade won't be fully appreciated for another 20 or 30 years. The five trading houses Buffett targeted, Itochu, Marubeni, Mitsubishi, Mitsui, and Sumitomo, have executed a similar model since their post-war reformation in the 1950s, using access to extraordinarily cheap capital to acquire and compound enormous assets across global supply chains. These firms, collectively handling $1.3 trillion in annual trade volume as of fiscal 2024, operate as diversified platforms that trade commodities, invest in infrastructure, and manage equity stakes in thousands of affiliates. Their secret sauce is low-cost funding, often backed by Japan's government financial institutions, enabling high return on invested capital, ROIC, with minimal overhead. ROIC, a measure of how efficiently a company generates profits from its capital, averages 12% to 15% across these houses, far above global conglomerates like General Electric's historical 8% to 10%, because they avoid heavy operational burdens by holding minority equity positions. Japan's five trading houses. Take Itochu Corporation, the most consumer-oriented of the five, with fiscal 2025 revenue of $98 billion and assets of $100.7 billion. Itochu accesses cheap capital through yen-denominated bonds at rates around 0.4%, far below U.S. corporate averages of 4% to 5%. It also benefits from government support via the Japan Bank for International Cooperation, YJBAIC, which provides low-interest loans for overseas investments. For instance, in 2023, JEBEC financed $500 million for Itochu's stake in a U.S. soybean processing plant, allowing it to deploy capital at costs below 1%. This enables Itochu to stack assets like its 50% ownership in Family Mart, Japan's second-largest convenience store chain with 16,300 locations generating $5 billion in annual sales. Family Mart's steady cash flows, $800 million in operating profit, compound at 10% ROIC with low capex, as ITOCHU focuses on equity returns rather than running stores day-to-day. Similarly, ITOCHU's 10 million tons of annual U.S. soybean trading leverages Keiretsu ties, loose alliances with banks like Sumitomo Mitsui, providing preferential lending. As Buffett noted in his 2020 letter about capital allocation, the best businesses are those that can deploy large amounts of incremental capital at very high rates of return. ITOCHU exemplifies this, with its trading float, supplier credits turning over 9 times yearly, acting like Berkshire's insurance float to fund acquisitions without diluting equity. Marubeni Corporation, with $52 billion in 2025 revenue and $61.3 billion in assets, specializes in resources and food, using government-backed financing to build a portfolio yielding 14% ROIC. Marubeni issues 10-year yen bonds at 0.4% yields, a fraction of global peers like Cargill's 3% to 4% borrowing costs. ABEC has been instrumental. In 2018, it provided $1.2 billion in loans for Marubeni's 15% stake in Australia's Roy Hill iron ore mine, which produces 60 million tons annually at $20 per ton costs, generating $800 million in annual profits for Marubeni. This low-cost capital allows Marubeni to stack assets like its U.S. logistics parks valued at $1.3 billion, where equity method accounting means Marubeni captures 22% returns without operational overhead. Meanwhile, government export credit agencies, like Nippon Export and Investment Insurance (NEXI), insure Marubeni's overseas risks, effectively socializing potential losses. And Marubeni's Keiretsu with Mizuho Bank provides revolving credit lines at near-zero rates, funding expansions like its $500 million investment in Creekstone Farms beef processing, which exports 200,000 tons yearly to Japan. Mitsubishi Corporation, the largest by scale with $124 billion in revenue and $143.3 billion in assets, deploys cheap capital for 10.6% ROIC across energy and metals. It borrows via yen bonds at 0.4% and taps JEBEC for $3 billion in financing for its 20% stake in LNG Canada, a $40 billion project producing 14 million tons per annum, MTPA, at $8 per ton costs. Insurance against foreign political risk enables massive overseas investing. ABA covers 60% of political risks, which enables Mitsubishi to hold equity in 1,200 affiliates generating $3.3 billion in annual profits. And that's not all. Mitsubishi's 500 ship fleet, financed at sub-minus 1% rates through policy banks, turns over $4 billion in cash flow yearly. Mitsubishi's Keiretsu with Mufgak provides $10 billion in credit lines, funding acquisitions like its $2 billion stake in Cermaq Global Salmon Farming, yielding 200,000 tons annually at 18% margins. Ultra-low-cost capital, invested in very low-risk ventures, at scale, produce high-quality, dependable results. That's how to turn worthless paper money into generational wealth. Sumitomo Corporation, with $46 billion in revenue and $77.3 billion in assets, posts 12.4% ROIC through balanced investments. It issues bonds at 0.4% and uses JBIC for $2 billion in financing for its Qatar LNG stake, producing 50 million barrels equivalent annually. Sumitomo's Keiretsu with Sumitomo Mitsui Bank provides $4 billion in credit, supporting its $10 billion Australian coal mines with $600 million profits. And, the best of all of these houses is Mitsui & Company, OTC, Mitsui, the company I am recommending in this week's issue. Last year Mitsui & Company produced $88.7 billion in revenue on $106.7 billion in assets, achieving 11.9% ROIC. A great example of how it builds global revenue streams was its 2001 investment in Penske Truck Leasing, PDL. It leveraged JEBIC loans, 70% of the capital required at 0.5% rates, for a $1.185 billion stake in PTL, allowing Mitsui to extract $300 million to $400 million in annual dividends without capex. Government export insurance covers 90% of overseas risks, socializing costs while Mitsui privatizes gains from PDL's 440,000 truck fleet. Likewise, Mitsui's Keiretsu with Sumitomo Mitsui Bank offers $5 billion in low-rate facilities, which has funded its 32.7% stake in IHH Healthcare, Asia's largest hospital operator, pretty much the best forever business I can imagine. Thus, once again, Mitsui is leveraging its close relationship with the government to finance and build out key pieces of infrastructure at a reasonable profit. Never too greedy, never on the front page, and never engaged in conflict or brinkmanship. Buffett's Berkshire parallels this. Its $168 billion insurance float in 2024, costing under 1%, funds investments like Apple, $200 billion stake, compounding at 15% ROIC. And, likewise, Buffett sits behind management teams. He wasn't tarnished by Wells Fargo's antics. He guards his reputation as his most valuable asset. Everyone thinks he's a saint. He never engages in criticism or conflicts. And that's the magic. Ultra-low cost of capital. High-quality earnings from ultra-stable industries. Staying out of the press. Being the devil who's convinced you he doesn't exist. And, like Buffett in his early days, Mitsui & Company has even structured its portfolio so that, despite having large stakes, it doesn't have to pay for capital expenses or corporate overheads. That means its income from these ventures tend to be badly mispriced on its books, so something we'll analyze below. Public risks lead to private wealth. At its core, Mitsui has perfected a system that ingeniously leverages public institutions to socialize the costs of its capital and its risk-taking, while channeling the resulting profits into its companies. This mechanism, honed over generations, allows Mitsui to access near unlimited funding at negligible rates and to deploy it into high-return assets with minimal personal exposure. It's a model of remarkable efficiency, enabling consistent compounding that few Western conglomerates can match, and it underscores why firms like Mitsui & Company generate ROIC of 12% to 15%, far above global averages, while maintaining low overhead and capex. To grasp this strategy, consider the absurdity of the scale. Companies like Mitsui, with $106.7 billion in assets, borrow at rates as low as 0.4%, effectively free money when inflation hovers around 2%. This isn't market magic, it's the deliberate outcome of Japan's intertwined public-private ecosystem. The Bank of Japan, BOJ, the country's central bank, plays a pivotal role through its quantitative easing programs, initiated in 2001 and expanded massively after 2013 under Abenomics, by purchasing trillions in government bonds. $4.5 trillion on the BOJ's balance sheet as of 2025, the central bank suppresses yields, allowing corporations to issue debt at rock-bottom costs. For the Sogo Shosha, this translates to 10-year yen bonds yielding 0.4% to 0.5%, compared to U.S. conglomerates paying 4% to 5% on similar debt. Public data from the BOJ shows that K has injected over $5 trillion into the economy since 2013. Indirectly subsidizing corporate borrowing by keeping rates artificially low. Layer on state-backed institutions like JEBEC, a bank fully owned by the government with $150 billion in assets. ABA Preberg provides low-interest loans and guarantees for overseas projects, often at rates below 1%, covering up to 70% of political and commercial risks. This socializes potential losses. Taxpayers bear the brunt if deals sour, while the Shosha capture the upside. For instance, as I explained above, in Mitsui's Sakhalin 2 project, JEBEC extended $3.7 billion in 2008 loans, part of a $5.3 billion package with private banks adding $1.6 billion, plus another $1.4 billion in 2009. These non-recourse facilities, repaid from project revenue, allowed Mitsui to finance its 12.5% stake without tying up corporate balance sheets, extracting $150 million to $200 million in annual dividends at minimal cost. This framework extends across the five trading houses Buffett favors. Mitsubishi Corporation, for example, secured $3 billion from JEBEC in 2018 for its 20% stake in the $40 billion LNG Canada project, borrowing at sub-1% rates backed by export credit guarantees. The result? Mitsubishi generates $600 million in annual profits from the 14 MTPA facility with limited capex exposure, achieving 10% to 12% ROIC. Public filings show JEBEC has disbursed over $200 billion in energy-related loans since 2010, much flowing to Shosha projects. ITOCHU, meanwhile, tapped $500 million in JEBEC financing in 2023 for a U.S. soybean plant, issuing bonds at 0.4% to fund equity stakes that yield 16% ROIC through trading volumes of 10 million tons annually. Marubeni follows suit, using $1.2 billion in JEBEC loans for its Roy Hill iron ore mine in Australia, producing 60 million tons yearly at $20 per ton costs for $800 million in profits. Sumitomo accessed $2 billion for Qatar LNG expansions, leveraging Nexi insurance to protect against geopolitical risks. Across the group, These tools have enabled $50 million to $60 billion in government-backed financing as of 2024, per JEBIC annual reports. The Ministry of Economy, Trade, and Industry, MITI, further subsidizes through grants and research and development, R&D, support, totaling $10 billion to $15 billion annually for strategic sectors. The ingenuity lies in how this socialized capital flows into privatized gains. The Shosha operate as holding companies, using Kiretsu networks, alliances with banks like Sumitomo Mitsui or MOVE providing $5 billion to $10 billion in preferential credit lines to acquire minority equity stakes. This platform investor model minimizes operational overhead, Mitsui and company, for instance, captures returns from PTL's $300 million to $400 million dividends without having to manage 440,000 trucks. Equity method accounting books proportional profits without consolidating debts, inflating ROIC by avoiding full capex burdens. As Buffett observed in his 1995 letter, good businesses require almost no capital, a principle the Shosha embodies, deploying cheap, state-subsidized funds into assets compounding at double-digit rates. For investors, this asymmetry is gold. Low effective costs, 0.4% debt versus 12% returns, create a moat few can replicate. Berkshire's insurance float, $168 billion at negative cost, mirrors this, but the Shosha's government ties add scale. This strategy, blending public support with private efficiency, explains why Buffett is drawn in, particularly to Mitsui and Mitsubishi, trading at discounts to their real-world asset values. Turning paper money into enduring wealth. In an era where central banks flood the world with paper money, eroding its value through inflation and debasement, the Sogo Shosha stand as alchemists of capital, transforming ephemeral credit into tangible, long-lasting assets. As global investors flee fiat currencies, seeking refuge in gold, real estate, or productive enterprises, the value of Mitsui & Company, which masters this conversion, is poised to soar. This is not mere speculation. It is the timeless mechanism by which the intellectual elite of business preserve and multiply wealth, a strategy Buffett has championed throughout his career. Consider the parallels drawn in Brett Gardner's great book, Buffett's Early Investments, a meticulous reconstruction of Buffett's 1950s investments. Gardner portrays the young Buffett not as a passive value hunter but as a discerning architect, sifting through Moody's manuals for entities where market prices lagged far behind realizable assets. The tale of Philadelphia and Reading Company exemplifies this. In 1954, amid the decline of anthracite coal, output had fallen 60% from 1929 peaks to 1.2 million tons annually due to competition from natural gas. Buffett spotted a mispricing. The company traded at $10 per share, with a market capitalization of $2.5 million, against net current assets of $6.7 million, $27 per share, including $6.8 million in U.S. Treasuries. He invested $35,000, about $400,000 today, his largest position at the time. But Buffett didn't stop at buying cheap, he activated value. Teaming with mentor Benjamin Graham, he launched a 1955 proxy contest, nominating directors to liquidate non-core assets worth $4.1 million and close unprofitable mines. Leveraging $20 million in tax loss carryforwards, the company acquired profitable businesses tax-free, evolving from a dying coal firm into a diversified conglomerate. The stock surged to $200 by 1958, delivering Buffett a 2,000% return. Gardner calculates this as part of Buffett's 29.5% annualized partnership returns from 1951 to 1956, outpacing the Dow's 18.8%. The lesson? True wealth accrues not from speculation but from owning undervalued claims on productive assets, patiently unlocking their potential. This is precisely how the very rich stay rich and grow richer, by acquiring dollars of hard assets for dimes, using mechanisms that shield them from volatility while compounding quietly. Mitsui, for instance, officially trades at a price-to-book, PB, ratio of about 1.0x, meaning $1 of assets for $1 of price. But our sum-of-the-parts analysis suggests an intrinsic value 1.4x higher, or 40 cents of upside per dollar invested. This isn't just a bargain. It's a vehicle for transforming worthless paper credit into hard assets worldwide, managed by masters of long-term wealth preservation. The discounts across the five Shosha stem from market misperceptions. Investors view them as opaque conglomerates, ignoring their platform model of minority equity stakes that deliver high ROIC with low risk. At Buffett's 2020 entry, they traded at 0.6x to 0.8x book, akin to buying 60 cents to 80 cents per dollar of assets. Today, even after 150% appreciation, versus Nikkei's 100%, they remain undervalued relative to peers. ITOCHU at 1.1x PB masks $100.7 billion assets generating 16% ROIC. Marubeni's 1.0x overlooks $61.3 billion in diversified holdings yielding 14%. Mitsubishi, at 1.2x, undervalues $143.3 billion assets at 10.6% ROIC. Sumitomo's 0.9x discount $77.3 billion at 12.4%. Mitsui & Company, while officially trading at 1.0x on $106.7 billion assets and 11.9% ROIC, offers the most amount of hidden value. Buffett's moves underscore this. From 5% a stake in 2020 costing $6.3 billion, Berkshire's positions grew to $30 billion by October 2025, with $2.1 billion in dividends net of yen debt interest. He raised Mitsubishi to 10.23% on August 28, 2025, 2 months ago, and Mitsui above 10% on September 21, 2025, per regulatory filings. As Buffett explained in 2024, it's been almost 6 years since Berkshire began purchasing shares in five Japanese companies that very successfully operate in a manner somewhat similar to Berkshire itself. In the next 50 years, we won't give a thought to selling horse meat water. Buying Mitsui & Company fits Buffett's early investing strategy like a glove. Gardner's book highlights how Buffett sought net-net discounts, market cap below net current assets, then unlocked value. Mitsui & Company mirrors this. Its $71 billion market cap lags a $100.7 billion sum of the parts valuation. But unlike 1950s cigar butts, Mitsui has much more left to give. It compounds at 12% ROIC via capital light stakes, turning paper discounts into perpetual wealth. This low-risk-slash-high-reward profile makes Mitsui & Company a legendary Buffett outcome in the making. If you own this stock, never, ever sell it. Action to take. Buy Mitsui & Company, OTC, Mitsui, up to $550 per share. Or buy Mitsui & Company on its local Tokyo Stock Exchange, TSE, 8031 JP, up to 4,200 yen per share. For instructions on buying international stocks, click here. Porter & Company. Stevenson, Maryland. Thank you for being a paid subscriber to The Big Secret on Wall Street. We hope you enjoyed this audio issue. In addition to this issue, you should check out our best buys where we highlight current portfolio picks that are at an attractive buy point today. You can find the best buys under the best buys link on our site at porterandcompanyresearch.com.